good evening, everybody, and welcome back to Reading with Rick. Can you believe it? We're back. It's the Christmas season, so we're going to take some time over the next couple of nights to read you and share with you some fun Christmas stories. We've got a couple of good stories here tonight. The first one is going to be called The Pokey Little Puppy's First Christmas. It's about a little dog and some friends he makes. Then our second book will be called Corduroy's Christmas Surprise. It's about a little bear, his friends, and his Christmas. And then we'll finish off this reading with Rick with a special story called A Christmas Memory. And that'll be a little bit longer story. And we'll, just like we did in the spring, we'll take a little bit of a break between those first two stories, and then we'll come back in case some of the youngsters have to get into bed and get ready for another day. So just like we did in the spring, we'll take a little break after Corduroy's Christmas Surprise and come back with a last story called A Christmas Memory. That was written by Truman Capote. So let's get started. This is our first story of Reading with Rick for the Christmas season. And this book, well, before we start, we need to take care of some other business first. We've got a birthday wish already. Happy 7th birthday today to Carson Klein. Carson, I hope you had a great birthday today. A big number 7 for Carson Klein. Happy birthday, Carson. All right, settle in for The Pokey Little Puppy's First Christmas. And this is about a little dog and some friends. Now, the story begins with 4 little puppies tumbling out of bed one morning and running to their breakfast bowls. Then they counted themselves. 1, 2, 3, 4. And the little puppies' names are Polly, Penny, Pickles, and Pat. Now, where in the world is that Pokey little puppy, they wondered. Well, Pokey was still fast asleep. His mother nudged him and said, "Come on, Pokey, today is Christmas Eve." Pokey yawned and stretched, and even on a special day like Christmas Eve, he was still Pokey. Pokey's family, the McCrays, were off to the woods this morning to find a tree, and the puppies were going along too. Pokey ran to catch up. Then, Pokey smelled something. He slowed down to see what it could be. If you have a dog or a puppy, you know when dogs are out, they love to sniff around and smell things. Well, that's when Pokey tumbled and stumbled and slipped and slid down into a deep, dark hole. "Help! Help!" he cried. Wouldn't someone come to help him out of the slippery, slidey hole? "I'll help you," said a friendly voice. "My name is Herman." Pokey looked up to see a young skunk peering over the edge of the hole. Herman climbed down into the hole beside Pokey, and he pushed Pokey up and out of the hole. "You smell funny," said Pokey. Herman sniffed. "You smell funny, too," he said. "Let's play." Herman led Pokey to a frozen pond, and the two new friends slid back and forth across the cold, shiny ice. What fun! Over in the woods, the McCrays had found the perfect Christmas tree near a hollow log. Mr. McCray raised his axe and whack, whack, whacked until crack, the tree fell. The 4 little puppies barked excitedly. Pokey heard his sister Pickles call, "Pokey, come on, Pokey." He was sorry to have to say goodbye to his new friend. "It's easy to find me," said Herman. "I live in a hollow log just over that hill." Pokey ran through the snowy woods toward home. Suddenly, he saw something. Pokey stopped to sniff the strange object up and down. It was an old red rubber boot. The boot was too wonderful to leave behind, so Pokey dragged it all the way home. "You're late," Pokey's mother scowled gently when he came through the gate. "See what I found?" exclaimed Pokey. His mother shook her head and said firmly, "You can't take that messy, muddy old boot into the house." Sadly, Pokey left the boot by the garden gate. After dinner, the puppies helped decorate the Christmas tree. When the tree was glowing with winking, blinking lights and shimmery glass balls, Pokey's mother told her puppies all about Christmas. "And to celebrate this special day, we give each other presents," she said at last. And then she sent the puppies to bed. Pokey, of course, was the last to reach the cozy cushion where the puppies slept. His brothers and sisters soon fell asleep, dreaming of rubber balls, biscuits, and bones. But Pokey stayed awake, thinking sadly about his red rubber boot. On Christmas morning, the puppies raced to the tree and found presents just for them. Pokey tore open his package. "My boot," he cried happily, "and it's all shiny and clean." After breakfast, a gentle snow began to fall. Pokey's brothers and sisters went off to play in the meadow. "Pokey, please don't be late for Christmas dinner," said Pokey's mother. Pokey ran out the gate, across the meadow, and into the woods. He was going to find Herman. It took a long time, but Pokey finally found Herman. He was wet and cold and miserable. "What happened?" asked Pokey. Herman pointed to a crushed hollow log. "That was my home," sniffed Herman. The McCrays had crushed it accidentally when they'd cut down their Christmas tree. Pokey felt so sorry for Herman. The little skunk was alone in the cold, snowy woods, and he had no home. So Pokey took Herman home with him. Pokey's mother was surprised to find that her puppy had made friends with a skunk. But Pokey's mother felt sorry for Herman, too. That night, she let him sleep in the doghouse she and her puppy shared in the summer. And Pokey gave up his warm, cozy bed in the McCrays' house to keep his friend company. The next morning, the most amazing thing happened. The Pokey little puppy was the first one out of bed. "Where in the world is that Pokey little puppy?" everyone wondered. The puppies and their mother and Herman followed Pokey's tracks in the cold, crunchy snow. They went out the gate, across the meadow, and right to the edge of the wintry woods. "Come and look! Look at Herman's new home!" called Pokey. "Why, it's your boot!" exclaimed Pokey's mother. "Merry Christmas, Herman!" said Pokey, "even if it is a day late." Pokey's mother was very proud of her puppy. It was only his first Christmas, but Pokey had already learned that the best gifts of all are the ones you give. And that's a fun story called The Pokey Little Puppy's First Christmas. Good story. Always fun to read Christmas stories. All nice, warm, snuggled in, and Christmas tree lights are on, and maybe you're drinking some hot chocolate that your mom made for you. Our next story is called Corduroy's Christmas Surprise. And this is about a little bear. So let's get started with Corduroy's Christmas Surprise. There was only a week to go until Christmas, and Corduroy could hardly wait. This was one of the best times of the year. Corduroy loved the smell of his Christmas tree. He loved taking the ornaments and lights out of the closet. He loved stringing popcorn and berries and trimming the tree. And that was only the beginning. Corduroy's list of fun things to do at Christmas time went on and on and on. This year, Corduroy thought to himself, Christmas is going to be even more fun than usual. His best friends, Mouse, Rabbit, Dolly, and Puppy, were coming over to spend Christmas Day at Corduroy's house. And he had little gifts for his guests. So he pulled out the wrapping paper, tape, and ribbons. Wrapping presents always got Corduroy into the holiday spirit. That reminded Corduroy that he had written his letter to Santa. What did he want for Christmas? Well, thought Corduroy, it would be fun to have ice skates this winter. He could use a new warm sweater. Oh, and he'd always wanted a train set. And a new ball would be nice, too. Corduroy wrote his letter in his neatest, best printing. Just then, the doorbell rang. Ding dong! Corduroy put down his letter and went to the door. And there were Mouse, Rabbit, and Puppy standing in front of his house. And they were singing, "We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year." When the carolers had finished, Puppy said, "Corduroy, grab your coat and come with us. We'll go caroling at Dolly's house next." So Corduroy did just that. He put on his coat and scarf, and the four friends made their way over to Dolly's house. As they began to sing, Dolly opened the door. She looked so surprised. Then Dolly invited them all inside. "I'm putting the finishing touches on my gingerbread house," she said. "Why don't you four come in and help me?" A real homemade gingerbread house? Corduroy had to see this. And what a gingerbread house it was. It had lots of windows, a fancy front door, and a chimney. Corduroy could hardly believe his eyes. "This is one of the best things about Christmas," said Dolly. "Don't forget Christmas trees," said Corduroy. "And Christmas carols," said Rabbit. "And Christmas candy," said Puppy, as he gobbled some candy. "And Christmas presents," said Mouse. And everyone laughed. Then they started talking about what each of them wanted for Christmas. Dolly said she wished for a pair of ice skates. Puppy said he'd always wanted a train set. Rabbit said he could use a new sweater. And Mouse said a brand new ball would be fun. Corduroy didn't say anything. How could he tell them that he'd written to Santa to ask for all of those things? Back at home, Corduroy found his letter to Santa right where he had left it. He decided to make a few changes. What if there weren't enough presents to go around? What if Corduroy got what he wanted, but his friends didn't? So Corduroy pulled out a new piece of paper and wrote another letter to Santa, and this is what it said. "Dear Santa, please bring ice skates for Dolly, a sweater for Rabbit, trains for Puppy, and a ball for Mouse. I don't really need anything this year. Thank you, Corduroy." Corduroy put the letter in an envelope. In his neatest, best printing, he addressed it to Santa Claus at the North Pole. He stuck on a stamp and sealed the letter shut. Then Corduroy pulled on his coat, his scarf, and his boots, and he walked outside to the mailbox and dropped the letter inside. He hoped Santa would get it before Christmas. A few days later, it was Christmas Eve. The very next morning, Corduroy's friends would be coming over to celebrate with him. Corduroy was getting ready by baking Christmas cookies. He'd hoped he'd made enough. Before Corduroy knew it, it was time for bed. But first, he had two important things to do. He hung his stockings on the mantel, and he left milk and cookies on the table for you know who. Maybe Santa wouldn't be bringing anything for him, Corduroy thought, but he was so happy that his friends would get exactly what they wanted. Then Corduroy climbed into bed. All night long, he dreamed of the happy looks on his friends' faces when they opened their presents on Christmas morning. The next morning, Corduroy sat up in bed and rubbed his eyes. It was Christmas Day. It had finally come. Corduroy looked out the window to see a crisp, sunny day and a fresh blanket of snow on the ground. Then Corduroy rushed out to the living room to find lots of presents under the tree. Corduroy could see there was one labeled for Mouse and one for Rabbit. There was one for Dolly and one for Puppy. And could it be? There was one for Corduroy, too, and extra presents for each of them. Corduroy was so surprised. Now he really couldn't wait for his friends to arrive. Once everyone had come, Mouse, Rabbit, Dolly, Puppy, and Corduroy sat down together by the tree and opened their presents. Dolly got ice skates and a scarf. Rabbit got the sweater he wanted and a picture book, too. Puppy got the train set of his dreams and a new hat. Mouse got a ball and some warm winter boots. And Corduroy got ice skates and a sweater. How in the world did Santa know that he wanted them? But really, Corduroy thought to himself, the best Christmas gift of all was that he was surrounded by his friends on Christmas Day, and they were all so happy. That made Corduroy happy, too. He would have to write one more letter to Santa to say, thank you for the best Christmas ever. And that's the end of that story, Corduroy's Christmas Surprise. So pretty good lesson in both those stories about giving gifts instead of getting gifts and how fun that is. So those are our first two stories tonight. And if you need to hurry off to bed and get ready for another busy day tomorrow, we'll take a quick break and then we're going to come back with a story written a long time ago. And it's a fun story. We're going to tell you about that story and then come back. It'll be, oh, about 2 minutes before we come back here. And when we come back, it'll be called A Christmas Memory, written by Mr. Truman Capote.
Jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in one horse open sleigh. Hey, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in one horse open sleigh. Try this with me. Jingle bells, all the way. Yeah. Jingle bells, all the way. All right. Jingle bells, all the way. Jingle bells. Take it, Danny.
Okay, are you ready to continue reading with Rick? We've got a very fun story, and this is one of my sister's favorites. I actually never heard of this story, but she said it's one of her favorites, and I read it, and boy, it is a really good story. Let me just tell you about this story. It's called A Christmas Memory, and it's written by a man named Truman Capote. Now, the story is about a 7-year-old boy. And he lives in a house. He doesn't live with his parents. He lives in a house with a bunch of older people. And one of them is an older lady that is his distant cousin, but she's also his best friend. And this story was written and first published back in the mid-1950s in a magazine, but the story is actually set in the 1930s. So times were really hard for people, and money was hard to come by, and it was just a rough, rough time for everybody. So keep that in mind when we start A Christmas Memory by Truman Capote. I hope you really like this story, because I sure liked it. And I want to thank my sister, Jessie. This will be one I think I'll read year after year. So, hi, Remy. Remy's listening in Wisconsin. Okay, here we go. A Christmas Memory by Truman Capote. Imagine a morning in late November, a coming of winter morning more than 20 years ago. Consider the kitchen of a spreading old house in a country town. A great black stove is its main feature, but there's also a big round table and a fireplace with two rocking chairs placed in front of it. Just today, the fireplace commenced its seasonal roar. A woman with shorn white hair is standing at the kitchen window. She's wearing tennis shoes and a shapeless gray sweater over a summery calico dress. She is small and sprightly, like a bantam hen, but due to a long youthful illness, her shoulders are pitifully hunched. Her face is remarkable, not unlike Lincoln's, craggy like that and tinted by sun and wind, but it's delicate too, finely boned, and her eyes are sherry-colored and timid. "Oh, my!" she exclaims, her breath smoking the window pane. "It's fruitcake weather!" The person to whom she is speaking is myself. I'm 7. She's 60-something. We're cousins, very distant ones, and we have lived together, well, as long as I can remember. Other people inhabit the house, relatives, and though they have power over us and frequently make us cry, we are not, on the whole, too much aware of them. We're each other's best friend. She calls me Buddy, in memory of a boy who was formerly her best friend. The other buddy died in the 1880s, when she was still a child. She's still a child. "I knew it before I got out of bed," she says, turning away from the window with a purposeful excitement in her eyes. "The courthouse bell sounded so cold and clear, and there were no birds singing. They've gone to warmer country, yes indeed. Oh, Buddy, stop stuffing biscuit and fetch our buggy. Help me find my hat. We've 30 cakes to bake. It's always the same. A morning arrives in November, and my friend, as though officially inaugurating the Christmas time of year that exhilarates her imagination and fuels the blaze of her heart, announces, "It's fruitcake weather. Fetch our buggy. Help me find my hat." The hat is found. A straw cartwheel corsaged with velvet roses out of doors has faded. It once belonged to a more fashionable relative. Together, we guide our buggy, a dilapidated baby carriage, out to the garden and into a grove of pecan trees. The buggy is mine. That is, it was bought for me when I was born. It's made of wicker, rather unraveled, and the wheels wobble like a drunkard's legs. But it's a faithful object. Springtimes, we take it into the woods and fill it with flowers, herbs, wild fern for our porch pots. In the summer, we pile it with picnic paraphernalia and sugarcane fishing poles and roll it down to the edge of a creek. It has its winter uses, too, as a truck for hauling firewood from the yard to the kitchen, as a warm bed for Queenie, our tough little orange and white rat terrier who has survived distemper and two rattlesnake bites. Queenie's trotting beside it now. 3 hours later, we're back in the kitchen hauling a heaping buggy load of windfall pecans. Our backs hurt from gathering them. How hard they were to find, the main crop having been shaken off the trees and sold by the orchard's owners, who are not us. Among the concealing leaves, the frosted deceiving grass. Crackle, a cheery crunch, scraps of miniature thunder sound as the shells collapse, and the golden mound of sweet, oily, ivory meat mounts in the milk glass bowl. Queenie begs to taste, and now and again my friend sneaks her a mite, though insisting we deprive ourselves. We mustn't, buddy. If we start, we won't stop, and there's scarcely enough as there is for 30 cakes. The kitchen is growing dark. Dusk turns the window into a mirror. Our reflections mingle with the rising moon as we work by the fireside in the firelight. At last, when the moon is quite high, we toss the final haul into the fire and with joined sighs watch it catch flame. The buggy is empty. The bowl is brimful. We eat our supper, cold biscuits, bacon, blackberry jam, and discuss tomorrow. Tomorrow, the kind of work I like best begins. Buying. Cherries and citron, ginger and vanilla and canned Hawaiian pineapple, rinds and raisins and walnuts and whiskey and, oh, so much flour, butter, so many eggs, spices, flavorings, while we'll need a pony to pull the buggy home. But before those purchases can be made, there's the question of money. Neither of us have any. Except for skinflint sums persons in the house occasionally provide. A dime is considered very big money. Or what we earn ourselves from various activities, holding rummage sales, selling buckets of hand-picked blackberries, jars of homemade jam and apple jelly and peach preserves, rounding up flowers for funerals and weddings. Once, we won 79th prize, $5, in a national football contest. Not that we know a fool thing about football. It's just that we enter any contest we hear about. At the moment, our hopes are centered on the $50,000 grand prize being offered to name a new brand of coffee. We suggested AM, and after some hesitation, for my friend thought it perhaps sacrilegious, the slogan AM Amen. To tell the truth, our only really profitable enterprise was the Fun and Freak Museum we conducted in a backyard woodshed 2 summers ago. The Fun was a stereopticon with slide views of Washington and New York, lent us by a relative who'd been to those places. She was furious when she discovered why we'd borrowed it. The Freak was a three-legged bitty chicken hatched by one of our own hens. Everybody hereabouts wanted to see that bitty. We charged grown-ups a nickel, kids 2 cents, and we took in a good $20 before the museum shut down due to the decease of the main attraction. But one way and another, we do each year accumulate Christmas savings, a fruitcake fund. Those monies we keep hidden in an ancient bead purse under a loose board, under the floor, under a chamber pot, under my friend's bed. The purse is seldom removed from this safe location, except to make a deposit or, as happens every Saturday, a withdrawal. For on Saturdays, I'm allowed 10 cents to go to the picture show. My friend has never been to a picture show, nor does she intend to. I'd rather hear you tell the story, buddy. That way I can imagine it more. Besides, a person my age shouldn't squander their eyes. When the Lord comes, let me see him clear. In addition to never having seen a movie, she's never eaten in a restaurant, traveled more than 5 miles from home, received or sent a telegram, read anything except funny papers and the Bible, worn cosmetics, cursed, wished someone harm, told a lie on purpose, let a hungry dog go hungry. But here are a few things she has done or does do. Killed with a hoe the biggest rattlesnake ever seen in this county. 16 rattles. Dip snuff, secretly. Tame hummingbirds, just try it, till they balance on her finger. Tell ghost stories, we both believe in ghosts. So tingling, they chill you even in July. Talk to herself, take walks in the rain, grow the prettiest japonicas in town. Know the recipe for every sort of old-time Indian cure, including a magical wart remover. Now, with supper finished, we retire to the room in a faraway part of the house where my friend sleeps in a scrap quilt-covered iron bed painted rose pink, her favorite color. Silently, wallowing in the pleasures of conspiracy, we take the bead purse from its secret place and spill its contents on the scrap quilt. Dollar bills, tightly rolled and green as May buds, somber 50-cent pieces, heavy enough to weight a dead man's eyes, lovely dimes, the liveliest coin, the one that really jingles, nickels and quarters worn smooth as creek pebbles, but mostly a hateful heap of bitter-odored pennies. Last summer, others in the house contracted to pay us a penny for every 25 flies we killed. Oh, the carnage of August, the flies that flew to heaven. Yet it was not work in which we took pride, and as we sit counting pennies, it's as though we were back tabulating dead flies. Neither of us had a head for figures. We count slowly, lose track, and start again. According to her calculations, we have $12.73. According to mine, exactly $13. I do hope you're wrong, buddy. We can't mess around with 13. The cakes will fall or put somebody in the cemetery. Why, I wouldn't dream of getting out of bed on the 13th. This is true. She always spends 13ths in bed. So to be on the safe side, we subtract a penny and toss it out the window. Of the ingredients that go into our fruitcakes, whiskey is the most expensive as well as the hardest to obtain. State laws forbid its sale, but everybody knows you can buy a bottle from Mr. Ha Ha Jones. And the next day, having completed our more prosaic shopping, we set out for Mr. Ha Ha's business address, a sinful, to quote public opinion, fish fry and dancing cafe down by the river. We've been there before and on the same errand, but in previous years our dealings have been with Ha Ha's wife, an iodine dark Indian woman with brassy peroxide hair and a dead tired disposition. Actually, we've never laid eyes on her husband, though we've heard that he's an Indian too. A giant with razor scars across his cheeks. They call him Ha Ha because he's so gloomy, a man who never laughs. As we approach his cafe, a large log cabin festooned inside and out with chains of garish gay naked light bulbs and standing by the river's muddy edge under the shade of river trees where moss drifts through the branches like gray mist, our steps slow down. Even Queenie stops prancing and sticks close by. People have been murdered in Ha Ha's cafe, cut to pieces, hit on the head. There's a case coming up in court next month. Naturally, these goings-on happen at night when the colored lights cast crazy patterns and the Victrola wails. In the daytime, Ha Ha's is shabby and deserted. I knock at the door. Queenie barks. My friend calls. Mrs. Ha Ha, ma'am? Anyone to home? Footsteps. The door opens. Our hearts overturn. It's Mr. Ha Ha Jones himself, and he is a giant. He does have scars. He doesn't smile. No, he glowers at us through Satan-tilted eyes and demands to know what you want with Ha Ha. For a moment, we're too paralyzed to tell. Presently, my friend half finds her voice, a whispery voice at best. If you please, Mr. Ha Ha, we'd like a quart of your finest whiskey. His eyes tilt more. Would you believe it? Ha Ha is smiling, laughing too. Which one of you is a drinking man? It's for making fruitcakes, Mr. Ha Ha. Cooking. This sobers him. He frowns. That's no way to waste good whiskey. Nevertheless, he retreats into the shadowed cafe and seconds later appears carrying a bottle of daisy yellow unlabeled liquor. He demonstrates its sparkle in the sunlight and says, $2. We pay him with nickels and dimes and pennies. Suddenly, as he jangles the coins in his hand like a fistful of dice, his face softens. Tell you what, he proposes, pouring the money back into our bead purse. Just send me one of them fruitcakes instead. Well, my friend remarks on our way home, there's a lovely man. We'll put an extra cup of raisins in his cake. The black stove, stoked with coal and firewood, glows like a lighted pumpkin. Egg beaters whirl, spoons spin round in bowls of butter and sugar, vanilla sweetens the air, ginger spices it, melting, nose-tingling odors saturate the kitchen, suffuse the house, drift out to the world on puffs of chimney smoke. In 4 days, our work is done. 31 cakes, dampened with whiskey, bask on windowsills and shelves. Who are they for? Friends, not necessarily neighbor friends. Indeed, the larger share is intended for persons we've met maybe once, perhaps not at all. People who've struck our fancy, like President Roosevelt, like the Reverend and Mrs. J.C. Lucy, Baptist missionaries to Borneo, who lectured here last winter, or the little knife grinder who comes through town twice a year, or Abner Packer, the driver of the 6 o'clock bus from Mobile, who exchanges waves with us every day as he passes in a dust cloud whoosh, or the young Winstons, a California couple whose car one afternoon broke down outside the house and who spent a pleasant hour chatting with us on the porch. Young Mr. Winston snapped our picture, the only one we've ever had taken. Is it because my friend is shy with everyone except strangers that these strangers and merest acquaintances seem to us our truest friends? I think yes. Also, the scrapbooks we keep of thank yous on White House stationery, time-to-time communications from California and Borneo, the knife grinder's penny postcards, make us feel connected. Connected to eventful worlds beyond the kitchen with its view of a sky that stops. Now a new December fig branch grates against the window. The kitchen's empty. The cakes are gone. Yesterday we carted the last of them to the post office, where the cost of stamps turned our purse inside out. We're broke. That rather depresses me, but my friend insists on celebrating with 2 inches of whiskey left in Ha-Ha's bottle. Queenie has a spoonful in a bowl of coffee. She likes her coffee chicory-flavored and strong. The rest we divide between a pair of jelly glasses. We're both quite awed at the prospect of drinking straight whiskey. The taste of it brings screwed-up expressions and sour shudders. But by and by we begin to sing, the two of us singing different songs simultaneously. I don't know the words to mine, just come on along to the Darktown Strutters Ball. But I can dance, that's what I mean to be, a tap dancer in the movies. My dancing shadow rollicks on the walls. Our voices rock the chinaware. We giggle as if unseen hands were tickling us. Queenie rolls on her back, her paws plow the air. Something like a grin stretches her black lips. Inside myself, I feel warm and sparky as those crumbling logs, carefree as the wind in the chimney. My friend waltzes round the stove, the hem of her poor calico skirt pinched between her fingers as though it were a party dress. "Show me the way to go home," she sings, her tennis shoes squeaking on the floor. "Show me the way to go home." Enter 2 relatives, very angry, potent with eyes that scold, tongues that scald. Listen to what they have to say, the words tumbling together into a wrathful tune. A child of 7? Whiskey on his breath? Are you out of your mind? Feeding a child of 7? Must be loony. Road to ruination. Remember Cousin Kate, Uncle Charlie? Uncle Charlie's brother-in-law? Shame, scandal, humiliation. Kneel, pray, beg the Lord. Queenie sneaks under the stove. My friend gazes at her shoes. Her chin quivers. She lifts her skirt and blows her nose and runs to her room. Long after the town has gone to sleep and the house is silent except for the chiming of clocks and the sputter of fading fires, she's weeping into a pillow, already as wet as a widow's handkerchief. "Don't cry," I say, sitting at the bottom of her bed and shivering despite my flannel nightgown that smells of last winter's cough syrup. "Don't cry," I beg, teasing her toes, tickling her feet. "You're too old for that." "It's because," she hiccups, I am too old. Old and funny. Not funny, fun. More fun than anybody. Listen, if you don't stop crying, you'll be so tired tomorrow, we can't go cut a tree. She straightens up. Queenie jumps on the bed, where Queenie isn't allowed, to lick her cheeks. "I know where we'll find real pretty trees, buddy, and holly, too, with berries big as your eyes. It's way off in the woods, farther than we've ever been. Papa used to bring us Christmas trees from there, carry them on his shoulder. That's 50 years ago. Well, now, I can't wait for morning." morning. Frozen rime lusters the grass, the sun, round as an orange, and orange as hot weather moons, balances on the horizon, burnishing the silver-wintered woods. A wild turkey calls. A renegade hog grunts in the undergrowth. Soon, by the edge of knee-deep, rapid-running water, we have to abandon the buggy. Queenie wades the stream first, paddles across, barking complaints at the swiftness of the current, the pneumonia-making coldness of it. We follow, holding our shoes and equipment, a hatchet and a burlap sack, above our heads. A mile more of chastising thorns, burrs, and briars that catch at our clothes, of rusty pine needles brilliant with gaudy fungus and molted feathers. Here, there, a flash, a flutter, an ecstasy of shrillings remind us that not all the birds have flown south. Always the path unwinds through lemony sun pools and pitch-black vine tunnels. Another creek to cross, a disturbed armada of speckled trout frosts the water around us, and frogs the size of plates practice belly flops. Beaver workmen are building a dam. On the farther shore, Queenie shakes herself and trembles. My friend shivers too, not with cold, but with enthusiasm. One of her hat's ragged roses sheds a petal as she lifts her head and inhales the pine-heavy air. "We're almost there. Can you smell it, buddy?" she says, as though we were approaching an ocean. And indeed, it is a kind of ocean. Scented acres of holiday trees, prickly-leafed holly, red berries shiny as Chinese bells, black crows swoop upon them, screaming. Having stuffed our burlap sacks with enough greenery and crimson to garland a dozen windows, we set about choosing a tree. "It should be," muses my friend, "twice as tall as a boy, so a boy can't steal the star. The one we pick is twice as tall as me, a brave, handsome brute that survives 30 hatchet strokes before it keels with a creaking, rending cry." Lugging it like a kill, we commence the long trek out. Every few yards, we abandon the struggle, sit down and pant. But we have the strength of triumphant huntsmen. That and the tree's virile, icy perfume revive us, goading us on. Many compliments accompany our sunset return along the red clay road to town, but my friend is sly and non-committal when passers-by praise the treasure perched in our buggy. "What a fine tree! Where did it come from?" "Yonder ways," she murmurs vaguely. Once a car stops, and the rich mill owner's lazy wife leans out and whines, "Give you 2 bits of cash for that old tree." Ordinarily, my friend is afraid of saying no, but on this occasion, she promptly shakes her head. "We wouldn't take a dollar." The mill owner's wife persists. "A dollar, my foot! 50 cents, that's my last offer." "Goodness, woman, you can get another one." In answer, my friend gently reflects, "I doubt it, there's never two of anything." Home, Queenie slumps by the fire and sleeps till tomorrow, snoring loud as a human. A trunk in the attic contains a shoebox of ermine tails off the opera cape of a curious lady who once rented a room in the house, coils of frazzled tinsel gone gold with age, 1 silver star, a brief rope of dilapidated, undoubtedly dangerous, candy-like light bulbs. Excellent decorations as far as they go, which isn't far enough. My friend wants our tree to blaze like a Baptist window, droop with weighty snows of ornament. But we can't afford the made-in-Japan splendors at the five and dime. So we do what we've always done. Sit for days at the kitchen table with scissors and crayons and stacks of colored paper. I make sketches and my friend cuts them out. Lots of cats, fish too, because they're easy to draw. Some apples, some watermelons, a few winged angels devised from saved-up sheets of Hershey bar tinfoil. We use safety pins to attach these creations to the tree, and as a final touch, we sprinkle the branches with shredded cotton, picked in August for this purpose. My friend, surveying the effect, clasps her hands together. "Now, honest, buddy, doesn't it look good enough to eat?" And Queenie tries to eat an angel. After weaving and ribboning holly wreaths for all the front windows, our next project is the fashioning of family gifts. Tie-dye scarves for the ladies, for the men, a home-brewed lemon and licorice and aspirin syrup to be taken at the first symptoms of a cold and after hunting. But when it comes time for making each other's gift, my friend and I separate to work secretly. I'd like to buy her a pearl-handled knife, a radio, a whole pound of chocolate-covered cherries. We tasted some once, and she always swears, "I could live on them, buddy. Lord, yes, I could." And that's not taking his name in vain. Instead, I'm building her a kite. She'd like to give me a bicycle. She said so on several million occasions. If only I could, buddy. It's bad enough in life to do without something you want, but confound it, what gets my goat is not being able to give somebody something you want them to have. Only one of these days I will, buddy, locate you a bike. Don't ask how. Steal it, maybe. Instead, I'm fairly certain that she's building me a kite, the same as last year and the year before, and the year before that we exchanged slingshots, all of which is fine by me, for we are champion kite flyers who study the wind like sailors. My friend, more accomplished than I, can get a kite aloft when there isn't enough breeze to carry clouds. Christmas Eve afternoon, we scrape together a nickel and go to the butcher's to buy Queenie's traditional gift, a good gnawable beef bone. The bone, wrapped in funny paper, is placed high in the tree near the silver star. Queenie knows it's there. She squats at the foot of the tree, staring up in a trance of greed. When bedtime arrives, she refuses to budge. Her excitement is equaled by my own. I kick the covers and turn my pillow as though it were a scorching summer's night. Somewhere a rooster crows, falsely, for the sun is still on the other side of the world. Buddy, are you awake? It's my friend calling from her room, which is next to mine, and an instant later she's sitting on my bed holding a candle. Well, I can't sleep a hoot, she declares. My mind's jumping like a jackrabbit. Buddy, do you think Mrs. Roosevelt will serve our cake at dinner? We huddle in the bed, and she squeezes my hand. Seems like your hand used to be so much smaller. I guess I hate to see you grow up. When you're grown up, will we still be friends? I say, always. But I feel so bad, buddy. I wanted so bad to give you a bike. I tried to sell my cameo Papa gave me. Buddy, she hesitates as though embarrassed, I made you another kite. Then I confess that I made her one, too, and we laugh. The candle burns too short to hold. Out it goes, exposing the starlight, the stars spinning at the window like a visible caroling that slowly, slowly daybreak silences. Possibly we doze, but the beginnings of dawn splash us like cold water. We're up, wide-eyed and wandering while we wait for others to waken. Quite deliberately, my friend drops a kettle on the kitchen floor. I tap dance in front of closed doors, and one by one the household emerges, looking as though they'd like to kill us both. But it's Christmas, so they can't. First, a gorgeous breakfast, just everything you can imagine, from flapjacks and fried squirrel to hominy grits and honey in the comb, which puts everyone in a good humor, except my friend and me. Frankly, we're so impatient to get at the presents, we can't eat a mouthful. Well, I'm disappointed. Who wouldn't be? With socks, a Sunday school shirt, some handkerchiefs, a hand-me-down sweater, and a year's subscription to a religious magazine for children, The Little Shepherd. It makes me boil. It really does. My friend has a better haul, a sack of satsumas, which is kind of like a mandarin orange. That's her best present. She's proudest, however, of a white wool shawl knitted by her married sister. But she says her favorite gift is the kite I built her. And it is very beautiful, though not as beautiful as the one she made me, which is blue and scattered with gold and green good conduct stars. Moreover, my name is painted on it. Buddy. Buddy, the wind is blowing. And the wind is blowing, and nothing will do till we've run to a pasture below the house where Queenie has scooted to bury her bone, and where a winter hence Queenie will be buried, too. There, plunging through the healthy waist-high grass, we unreel our kites, feel them twitching at the string like skyfish as they swim into the wind. Satisfied, sun-warmed, we sprawl in the grass and peel satsumas and watch our kites cavort. Soon I forget the socks and hand-me-down sweater. I'm as happy as if we'd already won the $50,000 grand prize in that coffee naming contest. My, how foolish I am, my friend cries, suddenly alert like a woman remembering too late she has biscuits in the oven. You know what I've always thought, she asks in a tone of discovery and not smiling at me but a point beyond. I've always thought a body would have to be sick and dying before they saw the Lord. And I imagine that when he came, it would be like looking at the Baptist window, pretty as colored glass with the sun pouring through, such a shine you don't know it's getting dark. And it's been a comfort to think of that shine taking away all the spooky feeling. But I'll wager it never happens. I'll wager at the very end, a body realizes the Lord has already shown himself, that things as they are. Her hand circles in a gesture that gathers clouds and kites and grass and Queenie pawing earth over her bone. Just what they've always seen was seeing him. As for me, I could leave the world with today in my eyes. This is our last Christmas together. Life separates us. those who know best decide that I belong in a military school. And so follows a miserable succession of bugle-blowing prisons, grim reveille-ridden summer camps. I have a new home, too, but it doesn't count. Home is where my friend is, and there I never go. And there she remains, puttering around the kitchen, alone with Queenie, then alone. "Buddy dear," she writes in her wild, hard-to-read script, "yesterday Jim Macy's horse kicked Queenie bad. Be thankful she didn't feel much. I wrapped her in a fine linen sheet and rode her in the buggy down to Simpson's pasture where she can be with all her bones." For a few Novembers, she continues to bake her fruitcakes single-handed. Not as many, but some. And, of course, she always sends me the best of the batch. Also, in every letter, she encloses a dime wadded in toilet paper. See a picture show and write me the story. But gradually in her letters, she tends to confuse me with her other friend, the buddy who died in the 1880s. More and more, 13ths are not the only days she stays in bed. A morning arrives in November, a leafless, birdless coming of winter morning, when she cannot rouse herself to exclaim, "Oh my, it's fruitcake weather." And when that happens, I know it. A message saying so merely confirms a piece of news some secret vein had already received, severing from me an irreplaceable part of myself, letting it loose like a kite on a broken string. That is why, walking across a school campus on this particular December morning, I keep searching the sky, as if I expected to see, rather like hearts, a lost pair of kites hurrying towards heaven. And that is the wonderful story by Truman Capote, titled A Christmas Memory. So we'll come back and we'll have another story tomorrow night in 6:30 at the same time to pick out some good stories for you. And if you want to have any suggestions, certainly send me a message and I'll see what I can do. I can't promise that I'll find the stories that you're looking for, but I got some pretty good ideas on what stories we're going to have for you. We'll do it tomorrow night, not Saturday or Sunday. We'll take the weekend off, but then Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. So 5 nights, because Thursday is Christmas Eve, and, well, we don't want to interfere with all your family plans. So tomorrow night and Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, we'll be back with more holiday Christmas stories on Reading with Rick. See you tomorrow.